The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network.
Support for this show comes from Inner Engineering, a program to empower every human being with the tools for well-being from the distilled essence of yogic sciences. Visit www.innerengineering.com to learn more.
From Spirituality and Health magazine, I'm Rabbi Rami, and this is Essential Conversations. Our guest today is Joe Jackson. He's the author of one novel and six works of nonfiction. His book, The Thief at the End of the World, Rubber, Power, and the Seeds of Empire, was named one of Time magazine's top 10 nonfiction books of 2008. His newest book, Black Elk, The Life of an American Visionary, is a powerful biography of the Lakota holy man that reads really more like a novel. A review of the book appears in the November-December 2016 issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. Joe Jackson, welcome to Essential Conversations.
Thank you for having me.
You really do have a compelling writing style. I mean, the book is large, but it isn't, I mean, I know it's a biography, but you really write it. It's sort of a, I mean, sort of the narrative style is so strong. It's really more of a novel, though I know I'm actually reading the actual history. It was very compelling. What I know about Black Elk comes from John Neihardt's 1932 book called Black Elk Speaks, which has sort of become a New Age classic in American spirituality. Did you first hear of him through that book, or how did you come to Black Elk?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I was, I'm 61, so I was growing up at that time when both Black Elk Speaks and Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee were two big bestsellers. So, and I was taken by it. I mean, you know, I was a psychology and English major, but I mean, it's a Black Elk Speaks is a beautiful work. It's just, you know, heartbreaking.
How much of it is, I've heard criticisms, I don't want to get lost in Black Elk Speaks, but I've heard criticisms that it's not necessarily Black Elk speaking, but more John Neihardt speaking, maybe through Black Elk. Is it an accurate assessment of, or an accurate rendition of his teaching, Black Elk's teaching?
I think it's a pretty accurate rendition of his words and his meaning. But Neihardt was a poet, and he was trying to write poetically in what he thought was the Sioux Lakota vernacular. The book came from like 30 hours of interviews in May of 1931, stretched over weeks, and there is a book that's a transcript of the interviews called, it's by Raymond DeMalley, an anthropologist out of University of Indiana, I think it is. And he transcribed all of the notebooks and the meaning and the narrative are accurate, but it's an oral narrative. And so there's a lot of, and it was translated, you know, Neihardt would ask, Black Elk a question. Black Elk's son, who could speak English, would translate it for his dad, and they would go back and forth. And so there's a lot of repetition, and there's a lot of back and forth, and it would never have garnered the kind of literary reputation that that Black Elk Speaks has, because, you know, it's more of a, in that form, it has more anthropological merit.
Mm. And you, so you read Black Elk Speaks, and that's what triggered an interest in this?
Yeah, my nonfiction books, even though they're often stories of historical people, I mean, I usually am searching for a narrative that I can hang some sort of issue on. And my last book was about the flyers that were involved in the air race that made Lindbergh famous. And what became really interesting about that was that America made secular heroes and secular saints out of many of them, especially Lindbergh. And the process of that for me was was really interesting. So I was thinking, well, I would be interested for my next book to write about somebody who is an acknowledged holy man. What is the nature of holiness? And I looked around and, you know, I had remembered Black Elk from Black Elk Speaks, and I had heard that the Catholic Church was thinking of making him into investigating whether or not they could make him into a saint. And I do remember that during the 60s and 70s and 80s that several religious commentators had said that Black Elk was the only real American holy man to come out of the 20th century. So I kind of gravitated towards him.
So I have a couple of questions based on that. I mean, your sort of your definition of holiness, but we should let our listeners know that Black Elk was a Lakota Sioux medicine man, right. But in 1904, he's born in 1963. In 1904, he converts. He's 41 years old, if I've got my numbers right. He converts to Catholicism, and that's why the church was interested in making him a saint. It's not like they just were looking for a Native American and gonna canonize him. No, this was someone who became a Catholic, and I want to hear about that too. Yeah,
and according to the Jesuits, he was so good as a lay preacher that he converted 400 Native Americans across the United States to Catholicism, which was like phenomenal for the time. And for about 10 years, he was a very, very, very strong Catholic. He may have still been practicing in Native medicine, but he was apparently no longer participating in the traditional religious ways. But after about 10 years of that, his people on the reservation continued to die, and he kind of drifted into a interesting kind of ecumenical mode of thought, where he was both a traditional medicine man and a Catholic, although he kept his traditional beliefs secret for the longest time.
Because the church wouldn't have approved.
No, and they didn't approve when Black Elk Speaks came out. I mean, they jumped all over him. There was a lot of pressure from the Jesuits on the reservation for him to renounce what he had said in Black Elk Speaks. And one thing you have to realize, one thing that's really interesting, I mean, all of the commentary that I had read back when I first read Black Elk Speaks, I mean, it sounds as if the Catholics on the reservation at that time, that they were monolithic, that they were all opposed to Black Elk. But actually, there were a small minority of Jesuits who could see what he was doing. And even though they disapproved of his still being a traditional medicine man, they did not think he was going to hell, and they did not persecute him.
So what was he trying to do, blend the two traditions?
He was trying to blend the two traditions because he came to the realization, I would say around the 1920s, that one reason his people were dying was because they no longer had an identity. For the longest time, the American government and the church had embarked upon a program where the only way to save the Indian is to kill the Indian inside, and that meant just wiping out their tribal identity and their old traditional beliefs, and it just turned the Sioux into a despairing people.
It's interesting though that trying to wipe out their culture and then they're replacing it with Catholicism at a time when, you know, Christianity was Protestantism and Catholicism was very under a lot, you know, people were very suspicious of Catholicism
That's a good question. But you kind of have to realize that when the reservation system started, that the reservations were pretty much put under the control of various religions in the United States. So for the Sioux, the Sioux had always liked the Jesuits for the longest time. And at first, there were some Protestant religions there, but the Catholics were finally allowed in, and the Catholics were very strong in all of these six Sioux reservations in the Plain States. But other reservations out west across the United States would have, you know, would have Quakers, they would have Methodists, they would have Baptists. I mean, it changed from place to place. So the pressure, but in many ways, the pressure from Western religion to drop your old Indian beliefs was pretty much across the board.
And then, so that's interesting, especially when you look at his life, and I do want to get to his vision in a moment, but I guess one more question about his life, because he ends up, I mean, his cousin is Crazy Horse. He's present at Wounded Knee.
Right.
He's an authentic Native American medicine man steeped in that culture. And yet, not putting aside the Catholicism of 1904, he's also I don't know what you call it. I'm looking for a disparaging term, sort of the performing Indian in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. I mean, they turned, you know, the whole Wild West Show movement, if you can call it that, turned Native American culture into an entertainment for Europeans and others. So, what do we make of his wrestling with his identity?
Well, I think what happened is when he was, and this was pretty much the thesis of my book, was that when he had his vision when he was age 9, and he was convinced that his vision, a very elaborate vision that he had during an 11-day coma, that the gods had sent him this vision in order for him to save his threatened people. And the rest of his life was, but the vision, the way he told it, was very much a puzzle box. I mean, you know, many visions often are hard to translate, hard to comprehend. Revelations is a good example. What does it all mean? How does it all fit together? And he didn't always know how this huge vision of his fit together. And so every decade he would take a different route to try to find the way to unlock his vision and to save his people. And so after he turned into adult, before Wounded Knee, in the 1880s, he was a medicine man, but his people continued to die. So he thought to himself, I'm going to the whites are the most powerful people in the United States. I'm going to learn the power of the whites. And so he joined the Buffalo Bill Circus to go to England, which was the most powerful nation in the white world at that time, to learn the secret of the whites. He went there and he discovered that they had no secret that at least would translate back to the Sioux. So he came back just in time for the ghost dance, and he joined the ghost dance thinking, well, maybe this will translate my vision to me. And of course, the ghost dance led to Wounded Knee, which was just a tragic disaster. And he held on as a medicine man for another 10 years until 1904, when he was in despair. And that's when he picked up on Catholicism, and he stayed with that for about 10, 15 years exclusively. And his people continued to die, and they continued to wane. And he tried to find a path that combined the two religions, but he also believed that he had to preserve the traditional old ways. By that time he was about in his 60s, and he had come to believe that the only way to save his people was for them to regain their old identity, which was basically their old religion. So every 10 years, he takes a different route to try to translate this puzzle box of a vision that he has.
The vision is, I mean, I love the word puzzle box, because the vision is engaging and yet inscrutable. It's just like, yeah, what is this thing? I was surprised to learn that from the book that Carl Jung was very interested in it and tried to get Black Elk Speaks translated into German.
Oh yeah,
which I guess he didn't succeed, but he's trying to unpack.
Well, he did actually. He didn't get it. he didn't get it translated into German before the war. It looks like he first ran across Black Elk Speaks when he was in giving a series of lectures at Yale in either 1930s or 1939 on religion and psychology. And somebody handed him the book, and he took it back to Germany. No, he took it back to Switzerland, and he tried to get it published in a German press, but then the war intervened. And then once the war was over, he kept at it again. And in 1955, he actually succeeded in getting it published under the title Ich rufe mein Volk, which is I call my people. And then American scholars, you know, who were enamored with Jung, they kind of noticed what was in their own backyard, and then Black Elk Speaks was reissued in 1961.
So, and then you're catching up with him now decades later and bringing out this amazing biography. What did, I mean, it seems to me, and I hope I'm wrong, but I'm asking you, the people never stopped dying. I mean, it's not like he actually cracked the vision and found a way to you know, reinvigorate his people, or is that not true?
I think that was true during his own lifetime, which is really very sad, isn't it? But I do believe when I went to Pine Ridge in 2014, I think it was 2013. I talked to several people there on the reservation, and they said that first off, you know, in the public schools there on the reservation, that Black Elk Speaks is the one book that they can never keep in stock, because all of their students are borrowing them and keeping them. And they said that questions of identity is almost an existential matter on the reservation, because they have a lot of teenage suicides or suicide attempts. But at the same time, they have a reemergence of the old religious ways, such as there are, when I was there, which was a week before Powwow Week, there were old sun dances. And we're not talking the sun dances for the tourists, we're talking private sun dances where there's the piercings and the kind of tortured endurance that the Lakota saw as part of their heritage. And that was they saw that as a good thing. They saw that as a hope for the resurgence of the identity of their people.
So what's your own personal sense of that? Going back to the old ways is, you know, after doing all this research and seeing what's going on with the Lakota now, you think this is the way to do it? If they can, I'm assuming there's some authenticity to it. They're not simply imitating long dead ancestors.
No, I think to a large extent. The Sioux were known for. The Sioux were known for being tough, and they were known for being able to endure privation. And they had within their religion, they had a kind of long-standing conversation with their God, in which they realized that the world was the world could be unforgiving, and your own toughness, your own ability to endure pain and privation was what made you a Sioux.
Which doesn't kill you makes you stronger, kind of.
Yeah, kind of Nietzschean.
To quote,
yeah, right.
Nietzsche, yeah.
I don't necessarily think that, you know, back in the 1870s they were reading Nietzsche, but but I mean there is a certain element of that within Sioux society, and also it's a very private religion. I mean, in some ways, an early title of the book was American Job, because throughout Black Elk had this running conversation with God. Why are you doing this to us and to me? We're good people. We have followed your dictates throughout. They believed they were the chosen ones. And there was a lot of give and take, as in Job. So
that's fascinating. And unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. I mean, to me, the message right there, and the last thing it said was, watch out if you think you're the chosen people. We Jews have the same thing. That's why we wrote Job.
That's right. Well, you know, I know you have to stop, but it was really interesting because, I mean, you know, in the 1870s, when white America was clashing with the Sioux, these were basically two cultures that were very much the same. They both thought they were God's chosen. I mean, you know, we had manifest destiny. They had swept across the plains just as white America was, and their victories said to them that God beamed upon them just as our victory said the same to us. And so you have really two cultures that are the same.
Wow, that is fascinating. And we are going to have to leave it there. My guest today was Joe Jackson. He's the author of Black Elk, The Life of an American Visionary. You can learn more about Joe's work on his website, joejacksonbooks.com, and read a review of the book in the November-December issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. Joe, thank you so much for being with us on Essential Conversations.
Thanks a lot. It was fun.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you. Support for this podcast comes from Inner Engineering, a program to empower every human being with the tools for well-being from the distilled essence of yogic sciences. Visit www.innerengineering.com to learn more. Essential Conversations with Rabbi Rami is a project of Spirituality and Health magazine. Visit spiritualityhealth.com and subscribe to the magazine in either print or digital formats, and download the iTunes app for this podcast. The Essential Conversations is produced by Ezra Baker, and our program coordinator and executive producer is Alma Tassi. I'm Rabbi Rami. Thanks for listening.